Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Three Down Nation podcast. I'm Justin Dunk, joined by John Hodge and JC Abbott. You guys guided the podcast the last couple weeks and didn't drop the ball, fellas. Congratulations.
Yeah, it says more about us than the Tie Cats.
Oh! Or Tim White?
Well, Tim White was the one dropping the ball the first couple weeks. I think this past week, all the Tie Cats dropped the ball. But we'll talk about that more later in the show.
See, Dunk, I was going to say that podcast hosts are like running backs. They're just replaceable.
Ah, yes.
No, I don't think that's the same, bro. This podcast wouldn't be the same if at least one or two of us wasn't involved in a taping. Don't you guys agree?
I agree. I will also say, sitting in the press box at, I was about to say IG Field, at Princess Auto Stadium, a.k.a. The Paw, the Reichwell Armstead drop, which was a fumble after he quit on that play, happened right in front of us. And I remember thinking to myself, wow, a running back who can't catch and then gives up on the play, it doesn't add any value because, you know, any running back would have done that. You know, who needs a running back who can catch the ball and then know the rules? You know, no, you don't need that.
He ran for 100 yards in that game. Come on.
Yeah, and
now.
He took points off the board by, first of all, again, not catching the ball, and then secondly, not knowing the rules and getting on the ball. Get on the ball.
I still think he's better.
See
than
ball,
Williams.
Get ball. See ball, get ball. That is number one rule you teach to 6-year-olds when they start playing football. See ball, get ball. He didn't. He saw ball, left ball, and the Bobbers picked it up.
We're back in fine form, boys. Let's get it rolling. Today we're discussing a couple QB headshots from Week 5.
The Saskatchewan Rough Riders attendance woes.
Early season favorites to win most outstanding player.
Ryan Dinwiddie remaining committed to Chad Kelly as Toronto's starting quarterback.
And Sean Lemon's suspension being reinstated. But first, the Hamilton Tiger Cats are the CFL's only 0-5 team and entering their bye week facing several questions following a horrific loss to the BC Lions at home, during which the team was repeatedly booed by its fans. JC, can the Tabbies do anything to save their season?
Sure they can, but they gotta do it quickly, right? They're still in the mix in the East Division, right? There's still lots of time to recover. We've seen 0-5 teams go and win a Grey Cup before, but this team this week didn't look anything like that. That was the single worst performance by a secondary that I have ever seen in my lifetime of watching football, particularly in that first half. Now, should be noted, arguably their best cover player, Richard Leonard, was a late scratch for that game. Stavros Katsantonis, their all-star safety, goes out early with an injury, so they were hampered in that regard. But the amount of miscommunication and zone busts, I know we're probably going to get into some Vernon Adams Jr. conversation later in the show, and he was absolutely brilliant in that game, but the receivers were coming wide open with nobody within 10 yards of them simply because the defensive backs couldn't talk to each other. There was no communication. Simple concepts were coming free over the top, and they got absolutely picked apart like they weren't even there. I know that Milanovic made a move last week to get rid of the special teams coordinator Paul Boudreau. You wonder what sorts of decisions he's going to make about that defense over their bye week here, because it's clear from that game that they are in a bit of a crisis right now.
You wonder, and guys, I can't even believe I'm saying this, but I've heard a bit of chatter behind the scenes, if this provides an opportunity for Orlando Steinauer, hopefully I said that right, Orlando Steinauer, to get back to coaching, which is what he said in the past that he enjoys the most, and be the defensive coordinator with this team. Him and Scott Milanovic are extremely close. That was part of the reason why Steinauer brought him in as a consultant to Hamilton in the first place. And I think it could make a lot of sense because this defense under Mark Washington, whether it's just been, you know, too long hearing his voice, it doesn't seem like they're playing hard for him. That's no disrespect to Washington, but there's just too many coverage busts in the secondary. You know, I think they need to find a way to get more pressure as well. And we all know, I think we would agree, the three of us, that Steinauer was an excellent defensive coordinator and brought people together. I think that could be a change that is at least being talked about in Hamilton.
I also think it should be noted that Glenn Young is on the staff in Tigertown. He's their defensive line coach. He did great work as a linebacker and defensive line coach with the Winnipeg Blue Bombers late during the 2010s, helping them win a Grey Cup in 2019. He was the defensive coordinator in Toronto during the canceled 2020 season and for at least the very early portion of the 2021 season for non-football reasons, we'll call them. He was not able to stay with the team beyond the first few weeks of that year. But regardless, whether it's Orlando, whether it is Glenn, something has to be done about this Ticats team on the defensive side of the ball. They spent big money bringing in Jamal Peters as their boundary corner. Yes, JC, we need to remember that Richard Leonard was out. Richard Leonard is a very solid player. Stavros Katsantonis is a rock star at the safety position, but Jonathan Moxie, who has traditionally played corner at strong safety, or pardon me, at strong side linebacker, did not seem to work. Their halfbacks were desperately struggling, and their pass rush is just not good enough to cover up all of that on the back end. If you haven't already read Ben Grant's fantastic article breaking down all four of Vernon Adams Jr.'s touchdown passes from this game, please do so. But you know, to me, Scott Milanovich has already shown, right, with Paul Boudreau, that he's not afraid to make a change. That change has not paid any dividends in the short term. Now they've got a bye week. Another change might be necessary. And Mark Washington, I think, has done a lot of great work for the Ticats. But when you're that long tenured as a coach, I mean, he's been the DC there for a very long time. You can't have busts like this, especially for a guy like Mark Washington, who was a great CFL DB, right? If any part of that defense needs to be working, it's the secondary. Right now, not only is it not working, it is putrid. And Ticats fans, frankly, deserve better.
I think bringing Steinauer down onto the sidelines to manage that defense would be a brilliant idea. But in all this conversation, let's not entirely pass the buck on Scott Milanovich here, because I think most of us here on this pod were fans of his hiring. I like Scott Milanovich as a coach. He certainly has a particular reputation as a Grey Cup winner who went down to the NFL. Those are big-time accolades on your resume. But as a head coach, this is a guy who's 43 and 53 all-time. He's got a significant losing record. And that Grey Cup season was 9-9 before they got into the playoffs. His offenses have always been successful. He's been great with quarterbacks. We've seen Bo Levi Mitchell have a renaissance that we didn't necessarily expect. He's on pace for over 6,000 yards passing, but the rest of the team is not on par with that right now. And there are flaws all over. You have to wonder, is this just what a Scott Milanovich team looks like? Can he only improve the quarterbacks and everything else is always going to be flawed? That's going to be the knock on him right now, and he's got to act quickly to change that narrative.
I don't think so, man. You know, he's got the offense going, and you got to have guys in place who can do their jobs. And in this instance, it's Mark Washington. There's going to be a lot of focus on him, and I think rightfully so after that performance. But you know, when you have younger players that have to come into the lineup unexpectedly, because Richard Leonard, as you guys both pointed out, was a late scratch, that isn't necessarily ideal with Katsantonis out of there as well, who can kind of be the quarterback of the defense and helps them, all those younger guys get lined up. That's not ideal. Playing Jonathan Moxie at strong side linebacker never really made sense to me. I always felt like, especially talking to people around the league, he was better as a cover guy, especially at cornerback. So I never understood that move. That has to fall on somebody, and Scott Milanovich will tell you that he's focused on offense. I mean, he's overseeing everything, but to me, those decisions are made by Mark Washington and the defensive staff. And the one thing I feel
the
like
head coach, though, you can't pass the buck like that, right? Like, I appreciate
you can't.
That he's
so it
focused,
does start.
He's focused on the offense, but he's got to oversee the whole team. That's his job.
That's true. So it is going to fall on the head coach. But I think if you're in this instance, with you saying that, Scott Milanovich, you got to look at this and understand how Orlando Steinauer in the past was able to bring people together and was able to have success, you know, with multiple guys rolling through the defense, go to Fresno State and be one of the best assistant coaches in the NCAA, that maybe is where Orlando Steinauer is ultimately at his best. And we've talked about this with Paul Appelese before. It's okay to be a really great coordinator and maybe not necessarily be a head coach. You know, Orlando Steinauer has had success as a head coach, but in this instance, in the predicament the Ticats find themselves in, I think Orlando Steinauer, as your defensive coordinator, could help this team at least rebound and perhaps re-energize the fan base after, you know, nearly half or more of the stadium left. My colleague Bubba O'Neill at CHCH said he's never seen that many Ticats fans leave the stadium at halftime ever in his time covering the team, and he's an institution in Hamilton. So the Ticats need to do something to show the fans that they are trying to fix what is ailing this 0-5 team.
I want to say, and credit to Bo Levi Mitchell, 11 touchdowns, 5 picks through 5 games is solid. He is playing better than I think any of us anticipated he would. That being said, I do think we need to note a lot of his production has come in garbage time. It certainly did in this particular game. And also, he has thrown the ball in just 5 games. He has thrown the ball 214 times. And when you put the ball in the air more than 40 times a game, which is what he's doing on average, then obviously the yardage is going to come. Like, some of this is just coming as a result of sheer numbers, right? Of sheer attempts. Like, he is only averaging 7.8 yards per attempt despite having that 6,000 yard pace. By the way, that is the lowest average he's ever had outside of his last year in Calgary, which was 7.7. So yes, the offense is clicking, but it's clicking, I would argue, more by virtue of the volume of reps rather than the quality of reps. And they're getting a ton of reps. Why? Because their defense is getting scored on really fast, right?
I don't even think the offense is clicking. I think Bo Levi Mitchell in the passing game look good at times, but they have not been able to run the football, no matter if it's James Butler or whoever else is in there at running back. And I think you're bang on, Hodge. A lot of that yardage and touchdowns have come when they're trailing and trying to get back in the game. Yep. Same thing when they were in Saskatchewan, very similar to the Lions game, because they were behind by a whole ton of points almost right off the bat.
Yeah, looking at the... Go ahead, JC.
Don't forget about what we talked about off the top, like the drops, not just from Tim White, but from the other receivers, right? Maybe Bo Levi Mitchell wouldn't have to throw the ball so much and would have similar numbers if they were just catching it the first time around, right? There are flaws all over on this roster right now.
This team is on a bye right now. They come back at home against Toronto. If there's one way you can win your fans back in Hamilton, it's kicking this knot out of the Toronto Argonauts. So they do have a good chance here of at least, or I shouldn't say good chance. They have a good opportunity, right, to right this wrong in a quick succession. If they don't, however, they're in big trouble. They go to Edmonton in week 8 and then have a home-and-home with the Montreal Alouettes. That gets into the midway point of the season. One would think these next two, Toronto and Edmonton, are must-wins. And if you win them, you're right there in the thick of it. In the East Division, I think we're all in agreement, at least right now, that this is a one-team division with Montreal Alouettes dominating everybody, right? The rest of the season's probably going to be a competition to see who could visit the Montreal Alouettes in the East Final. Not dissimilar, by the way, to how it was last year, where the regular season was essentially a competition to see who could play the Toronto Argonauts in the East Final. So I'm not saying that The Ticats are completely pooched here, but what I am saying is they've got to hit the gas, and they've got to hit it now. Not tomorrow, not the next day. They have to hit the gas now.
Saskatchewan head coach Corey Mace took to social media to encourage fans in Ryderville to fill Mosaic Stadium. The team failed to crack 25,000 for its home opener and had the smallest crowd in new Mosaic Stadium history in Week 5 at just 23,923. Do the Riders have an attendance problem?
I don't want to go that far just yet, because the two Rider home games so far in 2024 have been on a Sunday night and a Thursday night. And when over 50% of your attendance comes from people traveling in from outside of Regina, then ideally you want to have those home games on a Friday or a Saturday night. President Craig Reynolds has told me multiple times in the past that their ideal game time is around 5 o'clock local on a Saturday, because it allows people to travel in that day or perhaps even come in the night before if they want to. And it also gives them time to enjoy that night and go home on the Sunday to get home in time for their work day on Monday. So I think part of it is that, and the other part of it is the damage that was done by keeping Craig Dickinson for the 2023 season and the stench of those seven straight losses. Corey Mace has wiped a good amount of that away and brought a new, nicer smell and vibe around this team, but it is going to take some time to win some of those hardcores back. There have been multiple people texting and calling in to the postgame show on CKRM that I host saying that they were in wait and see mode in terms of renewing their season tickets or just even about making trips to come to home games, even as much as it is an event in that province and especially the city of Regina, that they wanted to see that this team actually was different and had a different feel, and that they could at least trust the new head coach in the direction Corey Mace was going to take them. So I think let's see what some of the numbers are when the Riders have home games on Friday and Saturday nights, or even in those afternoons. I believe the July 19th game is on a Friday night against Winnipeg. You would expect a larger crowd because it is the Blue Bombers, their arch rival. But let's let this play out a little bit, because the buzz that you hear around the province there, you know, especially from the fans that I've talked to and that are calling into the postgame show and texting in as well, they all love Corey Mace. Now, it's easy to love a coach who starts his career 4-0 with his new team, especially being in Saskatchewan. But the whole, I can't state this enough, guys, feel, energy, vibes around the franchise is totally different than anything in the past number of seasons. So I think the fans will come back, but as we usually do at Three Down Nation, the data would tell us if indeed that's the case.
Yeah, and I've seen a lot of Rider fans defend the attendance on social media, citing concerns about the cost of fuel, the cost of game tickets, the scheduling as Dunk laid out, and I think to some extent that is valid. At the same time, this is Rider freaking nation. This is summer in Saskatchewan. This team is 4-0. They're wearing, especially last week, these beautiful jerseys, in my opinion, probably the best jerseys in football. I don't care if it's CFL, NFL, college, whatever. And you've got less than 25,000 people in the stands. That is, to me, unacceptable. And I do think it's wise to wait a little bit. By the way, last year when Winnipeg came to Regina early on in the season, week two, 28,299 at that game. I want to see at least 30,000 there. Obviously, some Winnipeggers, some Manitobans will be making the trip out to Mosaic Stadium for that one, which obviously helps. But this team is 4-0. It's Saskatchewan, and I'm saying this as a Manitoban, so please don't eviscerate me. There's not a lot going on in Regina, right?
Oh, boy. There's
a whole, if you listen to the Corner Gas theme song, that is the definition. There's not a whole lot going on. When the Saskatchewan Rough Riders play, it needs to be not just the number one event in the province. It has to be an all-out event. It has to be the thing that everybody is doing. And right now, it's not. People are staying home, as you've illustrated. So in a city where you're not fighting tooth and nail, like you might be in Toronto or Montreal or Vancouver to make these games an event, you need that stadium to be full. And I love the fact that Corey Mace has done, this is the first time I believe he's done it on social media, but he's said it many times, let's fill this building. And I think that honestly, Rider Nation needs to heed what the head coach is saying, just like the players need to do on a day-to-day and week-to-week basis. Listen to Corey Mace, show up to the stadium, because if Rider Nation can't sell out that building, I don't think they could call themselves Rider Nation. Like what are you at that point? You're like, what's you're the Rider province. You're not a nation. You got to earn that title.
Yeah, absolutely. Couldn't agree with you more, Hodge. I'm tired of all the excuses that we hear when we talk about this, because yes, I get that the games were on a Thursday and a Sunday, but games have been played on Thursdays and Sundays for many, many decades, right? And this was historically low numbers for the Riders, both for the home opener and for this particular Week 5 game. And yes, I get there are costs and everything, but to your point, you claim and you beat your chest like you are the best fans in the CFL. And for the last number of years, yes, the team has struggled, but attendance has dropped off. And when big events have come to town, we were all there for that Grey Cup in Regina 2 years ago. Rider fans weren't showing up, right? There are empty seats in that stadium, maybe that they had purchased, but once their team wasn't there, they didn't go, right? To me, you cannot claim to be the best fan base in the CFL if you're not going to fill the stadium through thick and thin, right? If you're not going to go there and be proud no matter what, and yes, demand better. Right now, you're getting better from Corey Mace, but you have to be there. And Rider fans aren't going to want to hear this, and I don't even want to say it because I've had my share of spats with Bomber fans over the last couple of years, but you're second best right now. You have fallen behind, okay? You have lost the title. You are no longer the champions. If you want it, you got to prove it. You got to get it back.
In my opinion, that's just in terms of attendance, because you can go anywhere in the world and you might see somebody wearing green and white, right, JC? Just like at the Rolling Stones
concert. That is true. I was at the Rolling Stones concert on Friday in Vancouver, and there was probably 50,000 people in Rolling Stones shirts and two people in Riders jerseys. So it's true. Merchandising, they're still on top. That person wasn't at the football game.
I think that Rider Nation does an amazing job of filling other sports and arts venues. They need to do a better job of filling their own venue. That's what I'm saying.
It should happen for the rest of the season, for all the rest of their home games, except for the Labor Day Classic, which is obviously on a Sunday. And there's a holiday Monday the next day, so you know that'll be packed with Winnipeg being there. Their home games are on either a Friday or a Saturday. So that should definitely help attendance. The strong start should help. But the proof is going to be in the data, as I said. And, you know, I still do think that Rider Nation is the biggest fan base as a whole in the CFL because of them being all over. Like, dude, we get calls from, like, San Diego. There's people from Australia. Like, it's insane. East Coast, we got a call from, you know, a fired up fan in Atlanta, Canada, talking about that the Riders have never developed a backup quarterback, which, you know, was a bunch of junk, and we proved that wrong. But anyways, they're calling from all over the world into the post game show. But I do think there is some.
Life can always use more Cedar Point. And right now, you can get more Cedar Point for less with the Fun Day Bundle for just $74.99. Each bundle gets you admission, parking, and all-day dining for one low price. That means more coasters like Steel Vengeance and more nostalgic fun in the boardwalk area. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Credence to what John Hodge and JC are saying. And Hodge, you know, you're saying this as this big Blue Bombers homer. No, I'm just joking. Hodge is not a Blue Bomber fan. Can we just correct this for once and for all? He only wants to see the Bombers win when he picks them. He doesn't care if Winnipeg wins. He's not a fan anymore. Perhaps he used to be.
But let's grew up a Bomber
clear
fan.
This out, okay? You grew up a Bomber fan, but you are not a fan anymore. I want everybody to understand this, that you are unbiased, because I've seen it so many times. Dude, I'm pretty sure I've even seen it on the Ecclestown text line and in the post-game show where they talk about John Hodge being a Bomber homer. You are not a homer. JC is not a homer. That's not what we do at this publication. So for once and for all, can fans understand just a little bit? There's no homerism in the way that we're talking about this topic and everything else that we cover at Three Down Nation.
Yeah, I don't really understand it. Like, yeah, I've written and said a lot of very positive things about the Bombers the last four seasons. It's also been one of the best.
But they've been to four straight Grey Cups.
Well, it's been one of the best four season runs in the history of the CFL by any team. So if I wasn't reporting that and writing that, then I would just be a bad reporter who was making things up or denying facts. Also a fact, their record sucks right now. And Zach Collaros has not been very good. And
Hodge
I
said
have also,
the Bombers suck right now. He said, Did everybody hear that?
I said their record sucks right now. Don't misquote me. Their record does suck. I don't think they suck as a team, but they're mediocre at best. And I do think they're improving. But yeah, I've spoken the truth on the Bombers since I started at 3Down, which is 2015. And if you want to hear me rip the Bombers, go back and read some stories from 2015. I was very happy to do it. They were awful and had been for years. So no, I'm going to report it accurately. And I'm going to say this about Rider fans accurately. Step up. I had a math teacher in grade 8. This has stuck with me forever. He had several sayings that he would often say. The number one that he would say, excuses are for losers. Like, don't give me excuses. Only losers make excuses. I appreciate. And this doesn't go out, by the way, to the family where it's like, oh, we could. Like, the choices go to the Rider game or feed the kids. That's not the person I'm talking about. But the person who's like, oh, we could drop $1,000 renting a cabin this week and go onto the lake, or we could go to the Rider game. Those are the kinds of people I'm talking about. If you want to call yourself Rider Nation, go to the game. Surely there's 30,000+ people who can afford to go to a Rider game in Saskatchewan. That's like 3% of the population of the province. That's the people I'm talking about. You can afford it. You can go. And if you're a little sleepy at work on Friday the next day, your boss isn't even going to care because it's Saskatchewan and the Riders won. The Riders won. Who cares if you're sleepy on Friday? People aren't even productive on Friday anyway.
You can go to the cabin when the Riders are on the road or on the bye weeks. Lots of time to do that.
Exactly.
I would just like to state for the record that I am not a homer. I'm a hager, or as we established last week, a shager.
A shader!
And that has not changed for the record, even though Shea Patterson was better than expected. I am still a proud shager.
He was the best quarterback in that game.
That was not a high bar.
No, but it still counts, and you're wrong for being a shader.
He was more like Shea Butter, fellas. Ultra smooth in that
Shea Butter. Hey, the Riders have had the same blueprint essentially all season to win games, and that is don't turn the football over. Like, no matter what, just don't turn the ball over because our defense is going to be gobbling up them takeaways. And as long as they do that, they're going to keep winning. Doesn't matter who's a quarterback, I think.
Hey, all I'm saying is that his first career touchdown pass, he better give that ball to Sam Emelis because that was all on the receiver.
It was a nice play by Sam. That's true.
JC out here just discrediting everybody. Somebody had to throw the football, man.
Anybody
make the read, put it in the right spot. I don't know about anybody. Could you have made that throw?
Okay, maybe not anybody. I could have thrown a damn nice interception, though, Dunk. Don't get me wrong.
Just like Cameron Dukes.
Yeah, I could have thrown Cameron Dukes' pass to Marcus Sales for the pick six. I could have done that. I'm a professional athlete.
I'm actually not
highly debatable.
I'm actually not confident you could hit Sales.
Not factual.
That's okay. We'll move on.
Rider fans, come out to the home games. Check out the Harvard Studio 620 Lounge before the game. I'll chat with you. And then call into the postgame show. Man, it's easy. We'll all have a good time. Winnipeg strong side linebacker Retta Cramdy hit a sliding Drew Brown in the head with his forearm during Friday's game between the Blue Bombers and Red Blacks, drawing a 15-yard penalty for roughing the passer. Brown left the game and did not return. One quarter later, Tobias Harris went helmet-to-helmet on a sliding Chris Strevler, and though a flag was not initially thrown, the command center stepped in to assess a 15-yard penalty for spearing. Hodge, you were there in person. You could have seen the replays on the big screen and TSN and whatever else you wanted to see there. What did you make of both hits?
Let's start with the Cramdy Brown hit. And by the way, for those who don't attend games at Princess Auto Stadium, when the Bombers have a hit that might be illegal, they generally show it at most once on the Jumbotron, if not again. They showed that Strevler hit, and I don't even think I'm exaggerating here, 9 times. Because, again, it wasn't originally flagged, and they wanted to hype the crowd up and make them boo so that there would be a penalty. And lo and behold, it worked. But again, we'll talk about that more in a minute. I talked to Retta after the game, and this was his quote to me. By the way, and I'll take you inside the locker room here for a moment. I was interviewing Brady Oliveira, And then I saw Cramdy was available at his locker, and I made it about halfway there before I realized that he'd stood up and approached me, and he just looked at me. He's like, yeah, let's do this. Cause like he knew why I was coming over. He knew what I wanted to ask him about. And to his credit, he answered it like this quote, "It was second and long. He ran and it happened fast. I don't want like he played here." He of course, is talking about Drew Brown being in Winnipeg for 3 years. "I don't want to see him injured. He was close to the six. I dove. He slid. I was late, obviously. And I get that fans are going to say I'm a dirty player and all that. They have their reasons to. For whatever it's worth, I apologize. And I don't want to see someone hurt." Close quote. Now, I asked him, "Do you think Brown slid late?" And he said, quote, "A penalty is a penalty, so I'm not going to find an excuse. When a QB slides, you don't even have to touch him. They'll just blow it dead. I've just got to do a better job and not hurt Drew." Close quote. So to me, this was an illegal play. It was. I want to say that and make that very clear, just as I put on Twitter. But I also put on Twitter when the game was happening that I thought Drew Brown slid late. And I had a number of very angry Red Blacks fans in my mentions saying, well, of course he's going to slide late. He's going for the first down. And it's like, well, that is not a slide. A slide is you giving yourself up well before you're about to take a hit. If you want to fight for the first down, go for it. You just can't slide. You can't have your cake and eat it too, as much as I love eating cake. Drew Brown, in this instance, in my opinion, somebody who I have tremendous respect for, I have a good relationship from covering him in Winnipeg, he did slide too late. And to Drew Brown's credit, he talked to TSN in Ottawa after the game and said he didn't think it was a dirty hit. So if Drew Brown doesn't think it was a dirty hit, I mean, again, I do think it should be a flag because there was contact to the helmet, and any contact to the helmet should be flagged. But you've got to slide earlier because Cramdy was already bearing down to make the tackle by the time Brown slid. The other one, and I'm going to do something I don't think I've ever done on this podcast, and that is diss the CFL's officiating. I think the CFL's officiating, by and large, is good. Certainly a million times better than most people give it credit for. When I watch NBA, NHL, NFL, I'm always seemingly see officials make calls that shouldn't be called or make mistakes. And the CFL officials, I feel like, generally don't do that. Generally, I find CFL games well officiated. The fact that they did not see an obvious spear helmet to helmet on a quarterback is deeply concerning to me. And thank goodness for the command center stepping in and issuing a penalty for spearing. And after, by the way, that spear took place, all of the very angry Red Blacks fans in my mentions stopped tweeting at me for some reason, because Tobias Harris clearly took it upon himself to say, hey, Winnipeg's in the red zone anyway. It's only half the distance to the goal. I'm going to take Chris Streveler's head off. And the second hit was much worse. And Chris Streveler, credit to him, appeared no worse for wear after the game. I'm sure the adrenaline was pumping like crazy, but he also didn't practice on Monday. Is it related to the head injury or the head hit? I don't know. I'm not going to speculate. But the bottom line is, we need to protect quarterbacks in this league. Part of that is not smashing them in the head if you're a defensive player. And part of that is penalizing it when it happens, which is something that the officials on the field on Friday of last week did not do. So the league has to step up here with its officials and get it right the first time. And the defensive players across the league, whether it's Cramdy, who again apologized for his hit on Drew Brown, or Tobias Harris going rogue and vigilante and smashing another player in the head, we got to do better than this because it's a long season. The CFL needs its quarterbacks to stay healthy, and injuries are going to happen anyway. We can't artificially add to those injuries by, again, smashing people in the head. It's not good. It's not good. Cut it out.
I wrote off the post-game comments out of Ottawa, and I believe what you were referring to was actually not comments by Drew Brown saying it wasn't a dirty hit. That was by Dustin Crum, who talked to TSN 1200 after the game and said he didn't feel it was a dirty hit, but it was a football play. And the other thing that Crum said in those same comments, I agree with wholeheartedly. And he talked about how he doesn't like to slide because he feels that it puts him in a vulnerable position. And I know we talk about these hits several times a year. We sit here and we go, well, you know, it was a dirty hit, so it's a penalty. Absolutely accurate. But what is the defender to do, right? It wasn't intentional, but every time it's a slide. And I just want to get on my soapbox for a second and say, I think allowing quarterbacks to slide causes more injuries than it prevents. And I get that you want to take away hits from these guys, but it's like sticking your car in neutral and then coasting onto the highway and saying, well, it's fine because it's illegal if they crash into me, right? You're going to get hit. It's not going to happen every time, but at every 10 times you slide, one of those times somebody is going to come in a second too late or a second too high, and he's going to catch you in a bad way, and there is nothing you can do because you have put your hands up in the air and said, Jesus, take the wheel, right? And you can't prevent that injury. And I hate to see it every single time. Now, there's things we can do on the defensive side of the ball to address injuries, and I've talked about them in the four before. I think we need to make wrapping mandatory on all tackles so guys aren't throwing in with the shoulder with their hands by their side trying to make a big hit in that situation. That could prevent injuries too. But until quarterbacks are taking it upon themselves to protect their bodies, until they're going into contact engaged instead of sliding in like that, where frankly their head is almost always at the level where the defender's shoulder is going to be anyway, we are going to keep seeing these injuries. And it happens in the NFL. It happens in college ball. This is not a CFL only problem. But I would encourage, if I was coaching a team, I would never have my quarterback slide. I think there's a far greater risk of injury if you're taking off and sliding, unless there's 10 yards of space in front of you, than if you go in and say, okay, I'm going to drop the shoulder, I'm going to engage there. In particular, because, yeah, maybe you get banged up there, you get bruised, but it's probably not going to be a head injury. These injuries are almost always hits to the head that have long-term consequences. I absolutely hate the quarterback slide.
The one thing I want to note here is these plays happen in a split second. It's easy for fans to say, oh, it was a dirty hit or the official missed a call when you slow it down in slow motion on replay. That we're talking about, you know, a snap of a finger, split second, Drew Brown slides, Rhett Cranley's trying to make sure that he goes to the ground. The Tobias Harris one is different to me. I thought that was definitely across the line and definitely was a dirty hit. But again, even on that play, it's a split second. You got an ultra physical, fast quarterback coming at you that you know can lower the shoulder and run you over, and you want to make sure he gets down to the turf. So I think that often gets lost here, where a lot of, let's call it, armchair quarterbacks are sitting at home or watching the game, however they're doing so, and they're screaming out loud, whereas this is a fast game with high-level athletes. I don't want to go as far as what Randy Ambrosi's been saying, you know, fast and fun and entertaining and his kind of catchphrase, but it happens quickly. So I think we need to understand that, yes, we want to protect the quarterbacks and get these calls right as quickly as we can, but I felt like that process played out well, where the command center got an error that the officials made on the field, because again, even for them, this game happens so fast. So I just think we lose sight of that sometimes, that when it gets slowed down, it looks so egregious or it looks like it's an easy call, but it happens oh so quickly on the field. A blink of an eye, a snap of a finger, however you want to categorize the speed, it is very, very fast.
I agree with that. And that's part of the reason why I generally never criticize officiating. And again, and I've said it many times on the show, if you're a longtime listener, you've heard me say it many times, I think the CFL's officiating, generally speaking, is very good. The Tobias Harris hit, I thought, was a very, we'll call it a shameful moment from an entity that generally does well. But regardless, I don't think Cramdy's a dirty player. I do think that he was correctly penalized for this hit. Mm-hmm. Something that Mike O'Shea, and I'll give him credit for it after the game, explained very well and very clearly, is back when quarterback sliding kind of became in vogue, a quarterback could slide, and until they were touched, they would gain positive yardage throughout that slide. So if you started your slide at, let's say, the 42-yard line, and you slid for 3 yards before you were touched, your team would scrimmage at the 39-yard line. That is no longer the case. What the command center does now is they go back and they review the play, and they look for when the quarterback began the slide. And when the quarterback begins the slide, that is the spot where the team will scrimmage. So if you start your slide at the 42, The defenders no longer have to touch the quarterback, period. The command center will say the slide started at the 42. The team is scrimmaging at the 42. So that was what Cramdy was referencing in that quote. And thank you for correcting me, JC. You're right. That was a Dustin Crum quote, not a Drew Brown quote. My apologies. But regardless, the point is the defender doesn't actually have to touch a sliding quarterback, period. They just have to avoid the starting QB. But I appreciate that once you've committed, right, at full speed as an elite athlete to taking out somebody with a tackle, sometimes it's impossible to miss them at the last second, which is what I would characterize the Cramdy hit as. That is not what I would characterize the Harris hit as. To me, the Harris looked like an irresponsible, I don't want to say intent to injure, but you can't use your helmet that way, right? He led with the helmet. He smashed the helmet. That was 1975 garbage football. That is not responsible football that we want to see, which can help players stay more healthy. So I'm not against what JC is saying with the sliding, but what I am saying is already we have a system where if a quarterback slides, all you have to do is not touch him because his positive yardage has already stopped. That's all a defender has to do. Hopefully the next time a QB slides in the CFL, we will have defenders miss the quarterback. Boys, we are now officially one quarter of the way into the CFL season. Some teams have played five games, some teams have played four, so it's a little bit of an uneven landscape. That being said, I want to know, if the season ended today, who would be your pick for MOP? We'll start with JC.
Well, we alluded to this debate a little bit last week, and I bet I ripped you for your choice, and I said my choice, and then he went out and had arguably the best game by a quarterback all season, and that's Vernon Adams Jr., certainly in that first half before BC coasted the rest of the way. VA was my pick for MOP last year. I got laughed at. I got ridiculed. Everyone said it was a ridiculous choice. And all he's done is he's continued to look like the best QB in the league during the first quarter of this season. Right now, he is on pace for 6,307 passing yards. Now, I'm not a big on pace guy, but that would be second all time in terms of single season passing yards in the CFL. 39 touchdowns and just three interceptions. He hasn't thrown a pick since week one. I believe it's been 166 straight passes without an interception for VA. And that yardage is not coming from short dink and dunk passes either. In terms of balls thrown more than 20 yards, he's thrown 49 of them. The next best quarterback has 36, and he's completed 21. The next best quarterback has 14. His average depth of target right now is 14.6 yards. That is 4 yards more than any other starting quarterback in the league. Those numbers are truly ridiculous right now from VA. He's playing at an extremely high level, and he deserves to be the MOP front runner through five games.
We're going to talk about the quarterbacks a lot, and rightfully so, but I just want to note Alex Hollins, Tyson Philpott, and Justin McInnes, I think, deserve at least to be in some sort of the discussion here. And I almost feel like, you know, maybe like the NFL has done, I'm not saying the CFL should do everything the NFL does, but perhaps there should be an offensive player of the year award, because Alex Hollins is well over 100 yards a game, has four touchdown catches, 33 receptions for 573 yards. Tyson Philpott, who's one of those Canadians that can ball at the skill position, has 40 catches for 564 yards. He's over 100 yards receiving per game, has four touchdowns. And Justin McInnes, 31 catches for 482 and four touchdowns, on his own. But this debate, one quarter of the way through the season, comes down to Cody Fajardo in the East and Vernon Adams Jr. in the West. Vernon Adams Jr. clearly has the better numbers overall with what he's doing. But I feel like Cody Fajardo is directing and leading this absolute behemoth in Montreal. And it would be interesting to see if it ends up being these two at the end of the season, because I feel like it would be much similar to what happened in 2023 when there was the debate between Zach Collaros and Chad Kelly. And Chad Kelly didn't necessarily have the stats over Collaros, but it was Kelly who won unanimously. Now, I think I would lean at this point in the season Vernon Adams Jr. because I think he has been outstanding. But when asked to be, Cody Fajardo has been outstanding in his own right. He's almost completing 80% of his passes, fellas, 77.3% with what he's done. And because Montreal is so good, he doesn't have to go out and throw for the kind of yardage that Vernon Adams Jr. has through the first 5 weeks. That said, he's still pretty close to those numbers put up by VA.
I think you got this both wrong, because to me, the MOP is Zach Kolaris. And my reason for... I'm just kidding. No, that is what I would say if I was a Bomber homer. The MOP is VA. Okay? I said last week that Cody Fajardo would have my vote, and it's close. I thought about this for hours before the show started. I think it would be right now Cody Fajardo coming out of the East and Vernon Adams Jr. coming out of the West. I also want to do a little bit of a thought experiment here, because one of our criticisms of this award in the past is that it should be open up, right? We should have, you know, take the divisions out of it. Just have, well, if the three finalists were Vernon Adams Jr. and Alexander Hollins and Cody Fajardo, I wonder if maybe the Lions vote kind of gets split and then Fajardo wins, or if the three candidates were VA and Cody Fajardo and Tyson Philpott, maybe the Alouettes vote gets split and Vernon Adams Jr. ends up winning. So maybe the three isn't the right number. Maybe it's four finalists. Maybe it's five finalists, just to get more names out there. Maybe avoid splitting the vote too harshly to one side. But regardless, I do think this is actually a rare year so far where one candidate from both divisions makes sense. I certainly think Hollins and Philpott are both worthy of this. Justin McInnes has been sensational as well, as Dunk laid out. But to me, it's VA against Fajardo right now. And VA is one very small step ahead because of the performance that he just had. But we're only a quarter of the way into the season. I want to see more. Obviously, Vernon Adams Jr.'s numbers would be pretty ridiculous if he did finish the season with what JC laid out, 39 touchdowns to three picks. Dare I say, I think he's going to throw more than three picks, though. I think over the course of, if he stays healthy when you start 18 games, I don't think it's possible to finish the season with three picks. So I want to see more, but kudos to VA. Kudos to Cody Fajardo for having sensational starts to the season. Cody Fajardo, by the way, only needs four more touchdown passes to tie his mark from last season. He only needs nine more to set a new career high. He's on pace to do that by the midway point of the season. So obviously he has found a whole next gear to his game that, dare I say, we didn't even see in 2019 when he was the MOP candidate out of the West Division. So I'm excited to see where this race goes. And I also like your point, Dunk. It would be nice if there was an award for a sensational position player, because right now it is so hard to win MOP as a running back or as a especially a receiver. Because if you're putting up massive numbers as a receiver, obviously there is a quarterback getting those corresponding numbers. And generally speaking, people like giving awards to quarterbacks, for better or worse. So it's an interesting thought, at the very least.
I have another similar thought experiment that is coming up in the next couple weeks, because one of the things that's going to be a tiebreaker for a lot of people between these two groups, and you alluded to it with the three finalists thing, is, okay, who's got the better weapons around them? And I think it's pretty even, right? Both teams have some really exceptional receivers. You could argue one is better than the other, but I also think the quarterbacks are elevating some of their players. But in a couple weeks here, Keon Hatcher is going to be back for BC way earlier than expected, from a torn Achilles that happened in last year's West Final. He's already practicing fully with the team. He's five games into his stint on the six-game injured list. I would argue he's a better receiver than Alexander Hollins is. He was the go-to guy for the Lions. You add that guy into the equation on that offense. Now, does that help VA's case because all of a sudden he's going to put up even better numbers? Or does it hurt his case because now he's got one more all-star at his disposal than maybe Fajardo does? I think that will be interesting. One thing I do want to correct, Chad Kelly didn't win MOP unanimously. He won by a landslide, but I voted against him. Couldn't be unanimous.
Sorry, that's what I meant. My bad. Appreciate you correcting me.
Something that I am kind of sad to report is looking at the schedule, the Alouettes and the Lions don't play until September 6th. And their second meeting in Montreal, pardon me, in Vancouver, doesn't happen until October 19th, which is actually BC's last regular season game. So if things are going the way they keep going, where the Alouettes are going to lock up the East Division by the midway point of the season like Toronto did last year, we might not get a meaningful game between these two top dogs. That makes me sad. I want them to play next week. Well, maybe the Grey Cup. But I don't want to see just one game between these two teams, if it even happens. Let's remember, the Argos did not make the Grey Cup last season. No, I want to see three. I wish they were having a home and home.
That game will have meaning.
We'll hope so. When the Argos came to Winnipeg around that time last year, they kept Chad Kelly on the bench. They didn't play their full complement of players. So hopefully we'll get a full strength game, but I don't know. I don't want to wait that long. That's 2 months away still. It doesn't seem fair. If we had a time machine, we'd go back and have them play a home and home right now. It's now time for Hodges' Heritage Moment. On this day in 1980, Fred Biletnikoff made his CFL debut with the Montreal Alouettes at the age of 37. The former NFL star had recorded 8,974 receiving yards and 76 touchdowns over 14 seasons with the Oakland Raiders from 1965 to 1978 and was named to the Pro Bowl four times. He would catch 38 passes for 470 yards and four scores with Montreal in 1980, and is one of five former CFL players to be inducted into the Pro Football Hall of Fame. Fred Biletnikoff is still alive, having turned 81 in February. JC, who is your favorite former NFL player to play in the CFL?
You know, there's been some very good ones in my time. I always have a soft spot for Vince Young because he made me think I had the body of a professional quarterback.
Oh,
no. I mean, Austin Colley was good in one season of BC. I wish he would have been able to stay healthy. Chad Johnson was fun. But I'm going to go back before my time because I think this is one of the biggest names to come up to the CFL ever. And it often gets forgotten. Mark Gastineau, the former NFL Defensive Player of the Year, retired as the NFL's all-time leading sack leader, the head of the New York sack exchange with the Jets, came up for four games with the BC Lions at the tail end of his career, 2 years after he retired from the NFL. It was an absolute train wreck. I've heard wild stories about him. He obviously abused steroids during his time in the NFL, had a difficult time regulating his emotions, got ejected from his first game in the CFL at halftime for swinging an opponent's helmet and smashing it on the ground. So it was full of wild moments in just about a month in the CFL. But we often forget that a player of that caliber came up here in the same year that Doug Flutie did. So he got all of that attention. We need to remember Mark Gastineau from time to time.
For me, it has to be Johnny Manziel, because when he was at the height of his fame at Texas A&M, winning the Heisman Trophy, becoming the first freshman to do so, it never seemed like a possibility that a guy with that much fame and celebrity would ever end up in the CFL. Obviously flamed out in the NFL as a first-round pick with the Cleveland Browns, and I remember being at his first media conference, scrum, whatever you want to call it, with the Hamilton Tiger Cats at Ron J. Joy Stadium on the campus of McMaster University. And it just seems surreal, dude. Like, I know there's all these different things that come with Johnny Manziel, some of it baggage, some of it fame, some of it the attention, but it just didn't seem like it was real. Obviously, he was not good, to put it lightly, in the CFL, but I never thought that he would actually come here. Johnny Money Manziel actually came and played in the CFL, who is arguably one of the most famous football players, you know, dare I say ever, or at least in my generation.
Mine is Chad Johnson, because I was at the game where he caught his only CFL touchdown pass. It was at Percival Molson Stadium, and I was sitting in the end zone close to the side of the field where he caught it, and the crowd was red hot that night, and it wasn't because a lot of them, and keep in mind, I was not sitting like where season ticket holders would be. I was sitting in, you know, like the area where people like me buy tickets, where it's like, oh, I'm here for the weekend. I'll go to the Alouettes game. it was all people, all game, cheering, Ocho Cinco, you know, all game long. They just desperately wanted Chad Johnson to do something. Sure enough, he caught a touchdown pass, hugged the official. For some reason, wasn't flagged for it. That still bothers me. Contacting an official in any way, shape, or form is strictly forbidden. Apparently, unless you want to show him some love and just give him a hug. Maybe the official just needed it that day. I don't know. But he wasn't penalized for hugging an official. And, that's his only CFL touchdown, if I'm remembering correctly. So I'm glad I got to see it live in La Belle Provence.
Maybe Ocho Cinco just agreed with the official. Okay, I'm allowed to touch you without a penalty. I'll give you some of my post-game McDonald's cheeseburgers and cigars in exchange.
That could be. Yeah. Hey, I want to say that you're talking about Vince Youngbody. I'm on the same diet as Chad Johnson, but my body looks a lot different.
I feel a little
ripped off in the metabolism. Yeah, no kidding. Whew.
You're just not on the same workout program as Chad Johnson.
That's true. And I'm not hugging any officials, that's for sure.
Yeah. Put out some good vibes, Hodge. It'll do you good. Yeah. Stop hating on Rider Nation and all the other CFL teams that aren't named the Winnipeg Blue Bombers.
I ain't hating on nobody, except for that non-call Tobias Harris. That I am hating on.
Let's go to the three-minute drill. An independent arbitrator has reinstated the CFL's gambling suspension for veteran pass rusher Sean Lemon. Was that the right decision?
Yes, and I appreciate that it can be tough to find arbitrators on short notice, but I think that the way this has played out, frankly, is a black mark on the CFL. You shouldn't have a guy waiting and languishing this long for this situation to be resolved. And it's apparently true that we're not going to even get a ruling on this until August. Like, we have to find a way for players to, yes, have the right to an appeal, which I think that every player should have, but we got to get this sorted in less than whatever it's going to end up being, like 10, 12 weeks. Like, it's just not acceptable. Ticats head coach Scott Milanovic denied firing special teams coordinator Paul Boudreau. Denied firing him solely because of the team's late game squib kick against Ottawa in week 4. Did that make sense to you, JC?
Look, he made a lot of comments about firings or releases never coming for one reason, and then alluded to, you know, the kick wasn't why we lost. It wasn't ever one play. It should be noted, nobody ever asked him directly about the squib kick still. He brought that up every time when discussing it of his own volition. So that would indicate to me the firing was because of the squib kick. There may have been other reasons, but he is self-aware enough to know that people are wondering if it's because of the squib kick and trying to protect himself. It was because of the squib kick. The BC Lions and Hamilton Tiger Cats inexplicably both wore gray during Sunday's game in Steeltown. Was that a uniform fashion faux pas?
I happen to like both uniforms, but try imagining being Bo Levi Mitchell or Vernon Adams Jr. and picking out a receiver in a split second that you need to be able to do it and pull the trigger and think, is this for sure my guy? Like, I know the helmets are different, but even those are both black, so I think going forward, perhaps there has to be more communication between the teams to not have the same color being worn, because it's very difficult for the quarterbacks and I'm sure, you know, the officials and perhaps the guys calling the game at TSN and on the radio to pick some of the guys out. But no fashion faux pas. I actually like both those uniforms.
Maybe that's the Northern why that the Ticats were giving BC's receivers so much space. They were trying to be kind to VA. He's
like, okay, yeah, those are our teammates there out go. There.
Yeah.
That's an excuse to me, but sure. The Northern Super League has hired former CFL executive Christina Litz as its new president. Is she a nice fit?
Yes, I think Christina has an impressive resume from her time with the CFL. She's since worked for True North Sports and Entertainment, which for the uninitiated is the organization that owns the Winnipeg Jets. It's an impressive resume, and she's a Winnipegger, which I'm going to show my bias here, I guess, a little bit. We love a Winnipegger. Let's go. The Toronto Argonauts have signed former CFL first-round pick Daniel Joseph after he was cut during camp by the BC Lions. Can he help that team win games?
I don't know about that. I always thought Joseph was a guy who was going to have to make a bit of a transition to adapt to the CFL game, potentially move inside, but he languished too long, played in the XFL, waited a bunch of years before he came up here. I think that hurt him, and that's why he was cut almost right after being signed by the BC Lions. But it's a nice fit with the Argos because they just lost Deontay Knight being poached away by the Hamilton Tiger Cats. I think there's a spot potentially on the roster for Joseph to get that time to maybe adapt into a role along that defensive line. We'll see how it goes for him. Ryan Dinwiddie said the Argonauts remain committed to Chad Kelly as the team's starter if he's reinstated and returns from suspension. Did his comments on Kelly surprise you, Doug?
They did, just for the simple fact that it's really out of Ryan Dinwiddie's control. And from a public relations standpoint with the Argos, the Argos have not been great at throughout this entire saga, let's call it. I would think you would want to reserve those comments until something actually happens with Chad Kelly. Dinwiddie did say that behind the scenes, he's in regular contact with Kelly and they want to have him ready to play if he is reinstated and the suspension doesn't have any other games tacked on or there's no other discipline that he has to go through from the league's perspective. But the comments did surprise me because I think the Argos just need to understand, let this play out, see what happens, and if Kelly becomes available, then you can declare him your starter. The Winnipeg Blue Bombers have officially signed Lucky Whitehead. Can he make an impact for the blue and gold?
Possibly. I mean, I think Chris Smith has done some nice things since he got healthy and back there on the return game. And I think that when the Bombers have a quarterback who throws to them, like Ontario Wilson and Josh Johnson have shown some nice things. So if things work out perfectly for the Bombers, I bet they would tell you that they don't want Lucky Whitehead to play because that means that their young guys are stepping up for guys like Dalton Schoen, who are out for the year, or Kenny Lawler, who are out for at least the foreseeable future with that broken arm of his. But I do think the Lucky Whitehead is a nice insurance policy for a team that needs one. The Edmonton Elks have added Sean Oakman and Derek Moncrief during their bye week. Which of those two veterans will help the team get its first win this season?
I think Sean Oakman can plug and play in the lineup as a defensive tackle. He's going to be an upgrade there for Edmonton and potentially help them out. I'm a little skeptical about the Moncrief signing, though. He did not look good last year in Saskatchewan. It looked like he had hit the wall. And Edmonton has good players who can play Sam linebacker. Leon O'Neill Jr. has been impressive in his first season, I think. And Lucas Purifoy is on that roster as well. You can always kick him down from safety if you need to. It seemed like adding a player that wasn't necessarily a necessity, but somebody who was also past his prime. But I think they like the leadership that Moncrief can bring to that group. Oakman, however, will make an impact on game day for sure. Dunk, you reported running back Jamal Morrow was signing with the Calgary Stampeders. Is that still happening?
It was supposed to, but again, this wrist injury has held up his physical, and the Stamps have wanted to sign him multiple times going back to free agency. I think there's still a chance here that that actually gets done, but this wrist clearly, from the Stamps' perspective, needs to progress. Zach Collaros was back practicing with the Winnipeg Blue Bombers on Monday after missing week 5 with a thorax injury. Do you expect him to start in week 6 against the Stamps?
I do. I think that the Bombers held him up for precautionary reasons this past week, though it should be noted that Mike O'Shea has not confirmed anything. Wouldn't surprise me if he, as usual, waits until the very last possible second before declaring who will play. But yes, I do expect that it will be Zach back in week 6. We want to finish our show by wishing the very best to Steve Townsend, his wonderful mother, and of course his friends and family. Steve is a Ticats super fan. If you didn't read the Hamilton Spectator article from last week, please do so. Steve is, I mean, in every sense of the word, a true super fan. Him and his mother have dedicated a ton of time and energy to the Hamilton Tiger Cats franchise for the past several decades. I tweeted the article out and got multiple unsolicited text messages from people who have worked in Hamilton saying, yeah, you're not kidding. This is what this family means to that community and that team. Steve, who was born with some health complications, made the decision to medically end his life on July 16th. And we want to dedicate today's show to him and, of course, wish him and his family all the best. I thought the TSN covering the in-house honor of Steve this past game on Sunday was the best part of that game. No disrespect to Vernon Adams Jr., who threw for four touchdowns, but the panning shots that TSN got of the crowd, there were multiple people in tears. People obviously in Steeltown know exactly how much Townsend has meant to this organization and that city. And so we wish again him and his friends and his family all the best over the coming week.
Life can always use more Cedar Point. And right now, you can get more Cedar Point for less with the Fun Day Bundle for just $74.99. Each bundle gets you admission, parking, and all-day dining for one low price. That means more coasters like Steel Vengeance and more nostalgic fun in the boardwalk area. But you better hurry because this bundle won't last. Save now at CedarPoint.com.